Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Amazon, the online shopping giant, is looking for a second home. So far, Columbus remains in play, along with 19 other cities across the country. Columbus Business First reporter Tristan Navera has been covering the competition. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Amazon is rumored to be narrowing the list of finalists maybe this week. What's the timeline? What do we know about that?
Well, they have been saying very little about what they're going to be doing as far as narrowing things down further. From what we understand, though, it seems that they probably are going to need to make the decision before the end of the year to make the timelines they've projected. So it's very likely we will see some kind of short list in the next couple of weeks.
And what are your sensations about the likelihood that Columbus will remain in the running?
It's actually pretty surprising. The affordability of the city here has been really one of the assets that's been working in its favor. They've been looking at a lot of these larger metros, and as they have, they've seen some issues with workforce, housing particularly. Those remain some advantages in Columbus's area.
But housing in Columbus has been noted as a deficit as well. They don't think they can literally construct enough apartments. We're talking about 50,000 new jobs that physically can't be done.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely correct. There are some issues. Just about immediately, we're going to start needing another 5,000 to 6,000 new housing units to make up for, you know, an economic development win of this size. And we're already needing somewhere in the realm of 33,000 new housing units just to go with Columbus's natural population growth.
Right, exactly. It seems like there's construction everywhere. And then transportation has been noted as a deficit. Mm-hmm. How so?
So a lot of the cities that we're competing against, Washington, the Boston Metro, New York, obviously have more established mass transit. Columbus, in the meantime, has been lagging a little bit.
And it doesn't have any kind of light rail or to mm-hmm. move many people from point A to point B. It's just buses.
Yes.
Columbus is offering a 100% property tax break for 15 years. It's also offering a 15-year 35% income tax refund on employee withholdings. Columbus stands out as one of the few cities that is making public what it's offering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the cities that are in the running have been going to great lengths to hide their economic development packages that they're offering Amazon.
Why is that?
I think it's a competitive advantage. I think many of them see it as just a means to help them better compete, not only for future technology companies. Generally speaking, economic development has been something more secretive, especially as states are increasingly competing against one another.
Right. And we know that. So does that put Columbus at a disadvantage that it has made public what its offer is?
Probably not. The city is pretty well known. The kinds of incentives that Columbus has offered a lot of tech companies, some of the other similar major economic development wins, CoverMyMeds and a few of the others, have been well publicized.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about how Columbus stands in the running for the Amazon, the second Amazon headquarters. It's been a big story. Amazon has publicized it very, very well. What it has not publicized at this point is why it's choosing what it's choosing. It's now narrowed the field to 20, including Columbus. My guest is Tristan Navera. He's a development reporter for Columbus Business First, and he's been covering the story. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So nothing's free. When the city offers something like property tax abatements for 15 years, tax refunds, a third tax refund on employee withholdings, someone's going to bear the brunt of those costs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who does?
It's
the rest of us, the taxpayers.
There's going to be a lot of kind of different consequences for the city that does eventually win. Of course, there's been the study that rents are going to increase wherever we're talking here.
Demand goes up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there will be a number of things like that, yes. And it's not entirely clear yet. It's been difficult to try to compare another economic development project of this size in another city for how it has kind of totally impacted the citizens.
And if there is that kind of influx, and, you know, you wonder about the mass transit issue. One of the reasons why Columbus is probably sort of affordable is because we don't have that kind of mass transit option.
Yeah.
We're not paying for that.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
How have different cities been responding to this challenge that Amazon's put forth?
Well, I mean, everybody has kind of offered their own different incentives package. Some of the more front-runner cities, Atlanta, the Washington, D.C. metro, have been putting together a little bit more comprehensive plans for where they might see an Amazon campus. It's not a small construction project, to be sure. There have been all kinds of different kind of off-the-wall offers for the city. Different cities have offered, renaming parts of the town or something along those lines.
Where is it envisioned that an Amazon campus would go in central Ohio?
Columbus has offered three different areas. They definitely were very interested in something downtown. Franklinton, where some development has been happening, and then, of course, Easton, where there's a lot of availability. It's very difficult for them to find a place to fit this because, you know, Amazon initially needs 500,000 square feet, which is, you know, larger than Leveque Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it's going to need to grow to 8 million square feet.
John in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, John. Hello, John. Are you on there? I can't hear you. Okay, we will work on that. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about schools? Is there any expectation that schools will bear some of the brunt of this?
Well, certainly. I think the idea with the economic incentive package is that while the company itself might not immediately be paying the influx of residents of high-paying jobs, that will kind of, in a roundabout way, impact things for the better for the city.
John in Columbus, we'll try again. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Just got some questions. I'm not going to mention any particular names or anything, so I don't want to come across the wrong way. But I think in some ways, not to introduce the other things, that companies like Amazon are triple-dipping because you think about it. They're making cities give up all their tax breaks, and yet they're coming in and they're taking jobs away from the little man that's out there, so on and so forth.
What do you mean they're taking jobs away?
Well, because there's the storefronts are disappearing even further because of the distribution centers. And then on top of that, why are they going to have a stipulation? For instance, how many robots right now are already at the average Amazon? Suppose there's 100 robots and 100 workers. Why not make sure they only have 50 robots and 150 workers? Mm. Something like that.
Okay. Well, Tristan Navarro, has there been anything like that out there yet?
Well, I mean, he's got a point. There has been some conversation about, where Amazon is going to be finding people. We're already in a time where we have very low unemployment. These new facilities, there's a new one being set up in Madison County. It's going to be one of the largest employers there basically overnight. There's been some need from the economic development organizations to retrain some people. But there's still that conversation out there, too, that Amazon has a high proportion of employees who are on food stamps or some form of public assistance. And to be talking about these kinds of incentives while having employees already benefiting from the system is sort of a question.
Yeah, Amazon has talked about its 50,000 new employee or 50,000 jobs as the high paying jobs. They don't talk about the lower paying distribution employees.
It's true. But, you know, when you look at the spread of their workforce, and I think in central Ohio, there's something around the plan is 6,000 employees
already.
We've got a records request in from the state that there's something around 1,500 or so beneficiaries of public assistance that have Amazon as an employer.
Okay. And Blake in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Blake.
Hi. I was just wondering why we're trying to have Amazon come to Columbus when, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe they paid any federal taxes last year, and their workers complain of having so many issues like mental illnesses from not having time for breaks and having pressure from the managers in their warehouses.
Right. What is the advantage to having Amazon come to Central Ohio, Tristan Navera?
Well, a lot of the economic developers that have been working these kinds of jobs have talked about sort of the overall impact of having a headquarters. I mean, it's 50,000 jobs. They're typically going to be a lot more concentrated and higher paying. So there's kind of the conversation. The logic is that you know, this is going to mean a massive influx of young people into the city. It'll mean, you know, a lot more wealth coming in, and that will kind of, in a roundabout way, mean, you know, more coming to Columbus.
Seattle, you know, just had a relative visit Seattle, and they're like, they don't know what the big deal is. It's a really big, smelly, busy city now. It's not that great.
Yeah, and there's definitely a conversation to be had about, you know, the inflation that the city has seen, you know, in as far as cost of living, some of the struggles with urban development, you know, those sorts of things. They're conversations that we have to have.
Blake, thanks a lot for that call. What about OSU? What is the relevance of OSU in the Amazon equation?
Well, they're looking for one of the primary concerns that they have is they need the city where they land this headquarters to be able to source large amounts of talent for them. You know, a 50,000 employee operation is going to have a lot of turnover, and they're definitely emphasizing in their bids out to the cities that whichever winner needs to be able to turn out the tech. And we have enough of an ecosystem in town of technology-oriented jobs. Ohio State has been a big part of sourcing.
If Columbus makes the next cut, such as it is, do you think the company's expecting the cities to sweeten the pot? Do you think it's going to up the ante?
Yes. As we understand, it's probably going to be sort of a final offer situation where those cities that are being considered, they're going to want to see what else they can offer. They're going to want to see every other kind of detail they can. As we understand it, the Amazon officials that have been visiting the cities, including Columbus, were very, very, very focused on what kinds of incentives and what kinds of benefits the city will give them.
Hmm. And tell us and refresh our memories about that timeline. You said the timeline they're shooting for is they want to get started on something, the planning or whatever, by winter.
Yeah, the idea was at least to have the city selected by the end of the year. The problem is, you know, when they're trying to ramp up this operation, they're thinking it's going to, over the larger time frame, take about a decade to get up to 50,000 workers. But once they have selected the city, they're going to immediately and pretty quickly start trying to ramp up recruiting efforts, probably trying to figure out their square footage there and those sorts of details.
And as far as if Amazon, whatever city Amazon chooses, how does it work when an entity like that lands in a place like this? Does somebody from the city work as a go-between?
Well, they will probably definitely have a lot of liaison with the city for this. They typically, Amazon will hire its own economic development staff. It has a few in Seattle and has been hiring a few elsewhere around the country, including in Washington. There's going to need to be a lot of interaction as far as finding where they're going to locate their office. Probably, if it were in the case in Columbus, it's very likely it would probably be a new build.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would probably need to interact with the workforce development groups, Ohio Means Jobs, very rapidly in order to start finding how they can set up a team to source people.
Hmm. And who do you think what cities do you think are Columbus's biggest competitors in this realm?
So, and obviously the front runners are seen in the Washington area where Bezos has, you know, an operation already and the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. Atlanta, as I understand, has been a strong front runner, as has Boston. Columbus actually is competing against a couple of other smaller cities that are kind of on the grow that have had kind of some surprising wins, too. You know,
Indianapolis?
Indianapolis is one. They have a Salesforce investment. Nashville, a New York financial firm just announced it was moving its headquarters there and 1,000 jobs. Some of these smaller cities, Pittsburgh, have the affordability factor and also have that kind of desire as people look away from the coasts and towards more affordable places. A city like Columbus does stand well to attract technology.
Well, Tristan Navera, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tristan Navera is a development reporter for Columbus Business First. He's been following the story of where Amazon lands for its second headquarters. Anywhere in many cities across the country are competing. This list has been narrowed down to 20. It's supposed to be narrowed even further in the coming weeks. So we'll keep you up to date on that. And there'll be more Tech Tuesday coming up as well. On All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Automation, it's everywhere now, but companies are also developing robots to engage with us in our personal life. Take the Alpha 2, which does yoga.
Introducing Alpha 2, the newest member of your family.
Okay, Joyce, let's move to the next pose.
Okay.
With 20 joints replicating human motion, he's as flexible as a yogi.
Good job, Joyce.
Others awaken you, and still others are being marketed to help older people with everyday chores and with companionship. Ohio State University electrical and computer engineer Juan Zhang has worked on a robot that can track motion. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Did the Alpha 2 sound familiar?
Yes. You're very interesting, actually.
Tell us, when we're talking about social robots, what's the difference between that and an automated forklift in an Amazon distribution center?
Yes, this needs to have a very brief review of the history of the robots. Actually, robots had been with us for so many years, over 60 years.
We don't even notice them.
Yeah, exactly, until recently. And robots also can be divided into industrial robots. Non-industrial robots and industrial robots.
Okay.
And in fact, both United States leading in the world. And more than 50 years ago, first industrial robot was invented in the U.S. Then later, in the early 80s, the first industrial robotics industry company was formed in the United States. It's called the Unimation Robot. Then later, of course, sold to other country. And for non-industrial robots, like legged robots, United States also leading. And actually, Ohio State was one of the leading institutions for developing legged robots, later developed into social robots today. And like Professor Robert McGee and Professor Ken Wardrum, Professor David Orling, Professor Chuck Klein, Professor Hamami, they were all involved in robotics research. In the 80s, there was a huge Department of Defense project developing a six-legged robot. That was the first in the United States. That was 30 years ago.
I think it's interesting that when so much of our science fiction literature, mm-hmm. so much of our imagination is pointed in the direction of social robots and wondering about what that means. And that's really kind of a combination, not just of robotics, but also of artificial intelligence.
Yes, exactly. And people have been dreaming robots working, living with us, helping us. But unfortunately, it has been so complicated. And also the cost of the supporting technologies, especially the computers,
yeah.
the sensors, the motors, had been so expensive until recently.
What and changed it, until recently?
And recently, because of it's not that happened, say, overnight.
Yeah.
Over the years, the supporting technologies, like computers, become more and more powerful and less expensive.
Gotcha.
Like sensors, like vision, cameras, become so powerful and less expensive and so affordable. So people started to put them together to make it into social robots. And social robots also can be divided into different levels.
Okay.
The first level the robots only interact with human beings by voice.
Okay, so that would be like Amazon Echo?
Amazon Echo and Amazon last year, Alexa.
Alexa, yeah.
And it can recognize your voice.
Okay.
Then, in fact, to us, it's just like a communication device.
Right. We think of it interactive technology. I don't think of it as a robot.
Yeah, people call it a robot. It's
okay.
Fine. And so recognize your voice, then communicate your demand to the server residing in the Amazon, then get information and send information back by voice. Then two supporting technologies. One is speech recognition.
Okay.
Other is speech synthesizer. Those two progress to a point, become possible at a very low cost. Then Alexa becomes a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And Jibo recently is a device a little more sophisticated than Alexa. It can provide very small motion, and it has a computer vision system. It's a camera, and it can recognize your face. So that is another new technology.
Well, the Diebold one, what does you say can move very little as a what would it move to do?
Yes, the move will say towards you and with the vision, and it can see you. And for example, if you put it in the house, it can recognize which family member is coming in. Then it can react with you correctly. So the motion is just to turn the head a little bit without a lag, without a wheel to move around. Then the second level, social robots started to move around with wheels and with legs. And we do not see so many here, but in Asia, there are many. Actually, a little boy, it can move around.
When
they can
dance.
When
you say there are many, that people are seeing them around?
Yes. Yeah.
People out in public?
The people here in the United States,
uh-huh.
Sometimes we can see in the public exhibition.
Yeah.
Entertain people, but not see them so often in the house, in families, with you, because still the cost is an issue. The first level, interacting by voice, those kind of robots cost a few $100. A lot of people can afford.
Right.
For the next level of robots, which can move, wheels, legs, started to become expensive.
Okay.
A few $1,000. So not many people can afford. Then the highest level of robots, humanoid robots, say eventually become social robots to help people, is so-called Atlas robots by Boston Dynamics, also an American company in Boston. Those, from the robotists' point of view, from our point of view, the most highest level of robots today. But it costs millions of dollars.
So what do they look like? Is it something like out of iRobot? Is it something? The only thing I do is reference science fiction. Is it something like out of The Centennial Man? Is it something?
It's like a Centennial Man.
Okay.
It's like as big as
it's a machine-looking thing.
Yes, a machine-looking. It has two legs. It has two arms. It can open the door for you. It can run. It can carry a bag, so forth and so on. But it costs $1
million. $1 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wonder, do we limit our vision of robots to humanoid forms, or do you envision a future of robots that'll have 10 arms, 5 arms?
That's a very good question. Actually,
or is it a comfort level thing? We don't want to be around something that has more legs than we do.
Yeah, actually, the definition of robots today is very, very broad. So any device, any machine, which have full sensing capability, which can make intelligent decisions, can be considered a robot. And as I mentioned earlier, if the supporting technologies become more and more powerful, become more affordable, then we will see more and more these kind of devices in our life. Like a drone, small helicopters.
Oh, drones,
people consider them as robots. And today, autonomous vehicle, autopilot
is a robot.
And
but a social robot is a different animal, no pun intended.
Yes, social robots, different animal.
Yeah.
Actually, social robots sounds like very simple, but in fact, to the experts, most difficult, most challenge, because you have to make them very affordable. Otherwise, people cannot afford.
Especially when you're talking about a market of older people, that it tends to be really one of the poorest demographics because of the fixed income issue in the United States.
That is a very good point. And that point, to me, still is the area people like us need to concede. And old people, for example, you can see people use walker, very simple walker. And why not using robots to help them more? And old people, senior people, and the disabled people, they're sitting in the wheelchair, they're riding in the wheelchair all the time. Why not enable them to walk? And those all can use robotics technology. And again, the challenge is you have to achieve this function at a very low cost so people can afford.
Are you thinking about using walkers to maybe keep track of vital functions, that kind of a thing, heart rate, those kind of a things?
Yeah. Today, walker still can enable those people who can stand, but cannot walk for too long.
Right.
And cannot walk in a stable way, then use a walker. And I'm talking about further. People cannot even walk.
Okay.
People can stand. Sometimes people even cannot stand.
Okay.
So how robotics technology can enable them to walk and give them more freedom.
But see, when I talk about that kind of robot, I'm not thinking social, but you're thinking about merging it with social.
Yes, merging with social. We can equip those robots with interactive skills.
Personality Alexa Amazon.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Like, where do you want to go today? Which way do you want to turn? Do you want to listen to the radio while we walk?
Yes, this also is another challenge. You have to develop all kinds of robots and to meet the requirements of the people. And the trick is the low cost, again. People can afford.
It's the trick. I get the cost thing because it's technology. And we all know back in the day when I'm old enough to remember when the calculators came out.
Yeah.
And that was like a big, hairy deal.
Right.
100 years later, it's not such a big deal. But I'm thinking about how much do you study humans to understand what you want to achieve with robots?
Now, actually, human robots started from studying human locomotion.
Yeah.
And today at Ohio State, still some professors study human locomotion, how human actually walks. Turns out it's very complicated. Actually, there are so-called six determinants, six different elements or six different phases.
Of the process of putting one foot in front of the other.
Exactly. In a complete step, you can divide them into six phases. Then, plus the sensing capabilities, you can balance yourself. And when the floor, the terrain is even, and you can stabilize yourself.
Okay.
To make this possible for a two-legged robot is extremely challenging because you need to process a lot of data, process a lot of information, then guide the motions of the joint. I mentioned earlier, like Alexa, there is no motion.
Right.
Only processing the data. That's much simpler than processing the data and turn the data into the motion and make the motion stable. So this is reason why the human robot as big as a human being would be very, very expensive. And today, still not so capable as a human walking.
How do you what are your expectations for when this will be achieved? Will it be in our lifetime?
That's a good question again, but it's very difficult for me to answer. Mm-hmm. Okay, I developed the first two legged walking robots in the United States.
You did?
Yeah, I did. And
okay,
I also interviewed with the media at that time, and that question was asked at that time. But that was more than 30 years ago.
Okay.
Of course, tremendous progress over the years.
Yeah.
But today, we still don't see a human-sized walking robot in our environment.
And what do we mean by human size?
As big as a human being?
Yeah.
And the same structure?
A child or an adult or?
Looks like an adult. It's okay. Not a child.
Okay.
And help you walking outside of the door.
What about developing robots that are more like dogs?
That's a good question also. And the Sony company actually developed the first commercialized dog robot more than 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And they stopped. They quit. And recently they come back again.
Why did they stop? Just money?
Again, the cost.
Okay.
not many people can afford
the bottom line,
and
okay.
Not many people bought them.
But now things have been more miniaturized. Things are more affordable.
Exactly.
Okay.
They're coming back. Also, artificial intelligence, decision making, the voice processing, speech recognition, those supporting technologies become more and more powerful and affordable. So they come back.
Is this a geometric progression or is it very linear? I mean, the more we know, the more we don't know.
Yeah.
And then we have to make huge leaps and then it expands exponentially from there.
It's very different from the computer technology.
Okay.
The computer technology progress is like exponential. And at the most, I would say the robotics is linearly, in the technology linearly developing, getting better.
Is there do you like science fiction? Do you enjoy the human imagination and how it envisions or manifests the future with robots?
Yes. As a scientist, actually, scientific fictions actually always inspire us to do better things and to push the technology to the most. So that actually is the driving force for us.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed talking to you. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
That's Juan Zhang. He's a faculty emeritus at Ohio State University in electrical and computer engineering. And as he said, he developed the first walking robot 30 years ago. And we're still waiting for that, the pal that we have been promised in science fiction, maybe 30 years hence. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Samsung is getting into the smart speaker market with its Galaxy Home. The device competes with the Google Home and Amazon Echoes of the world. However, Samsung is entering the market late, which means it has to outperform the competitors. Here to talk about that and all things tech, Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Galaxy Home has a natural sound processing and sound steer. What are those?
So it's a way of taking the microphones that are going on around, kind of the speaker system and using it to kind of feel where the walls are in the room so that it can tweak each one of the speakers inside of it to produce sound appropriately in each direction so that it sounds like the room is, tuned correctly. When professionals set up speakers, they adjust them based on how the audio is going to bounce off walls and how it's going to be absorbed into the material around it. And they kind of adjust those speakers to fit. And Samsung and Apple and several others have created software that tries to mimic that.
How much does sound quality matter?
It depends on how much you care about how expensive something is. It's really what it comes down to.
There are
people like me who are not particularly thrilled about, the idea of spending more than $100 on a set of headphones. And then I have friends who will spend, $600 and $700 on headphones because they sound so much better. And when I listen to them, I lack that ear and cannot hear a substantial difference between the $100 headphones and the $700 headphones, but they swear by the difference. So it really just depends on how you appreciate sound and its quality. There are definitely people out there who just love the highest possible quality audio. And then there are people like me who, will listen to a movie on the speakers on his iPad and think that sounds fine.
So Galaxy Homes is the Bixby 2.0?
Yeah, so this is, taking the entire Samsung experience. This pulls in the voice intelligence system that Samsung has been working on through its Bixby service that you can find on in its phones and weirdly on refrigerators and in a couple other places Samsung has been working on. And it's taking that and putting it in this system so that it ties into all of the other kind of Samsung-based equipment.
And there's changes coming with that, right?
This is something Samsung has been working really hard on for the last couple of years to make it so that it competes with Google Home and with Siri and with Alexa. And in truth, it has not been anywhere close to competing with any of those up until this point. But the most recent update that launched with the Samsung Galaxy Note 9 has a ton of improvements that seem to show a lot of promise that they're heading towards that kind of intelligent assistant for the entire home instead of just on your phone.
Mm-hmm. Why did you say weirdly the refrigerator?
Because having a refrigerator that talks to you is unusual and not something I think most people have in their home right now.
Well, it's funny because where we have our smart speaker is in our kitchen.
Oh, absolutely. I have one in my kitchen as well.
I'm sure you have one in every room in your house.
I don't. The one that I primarily use it in is the kitchen because I like having music playing while I'm cooking or something like that. But or like as an egg timer, it's surprisingly effective as kind of an egg timer. But yeah, this, having it built into the refrigerator in particular, Samsung's crazy smart refrigerator will tell you like what, how much milk you have left and stuff like that. It's very futuristic.
Now, Samsung has worked to make Bixby feel less like a robot, similar to Google Assistant. How so?
It all comes down to kind of that natural language processing. When you ask, it has to do with how you ask questions and how you receive responses. So with Siri, you kind of ask a very technical question and you get a very straightforward answer. You want it to search for this kind of thing, and then that conversation kind of ends with that interaction. Google Home started this kind of natural language thing in two ways. One, by allowing you to give multiple commands in a single sentence just by using and in between those two commands, which is, how we talk to people. And then also, responding to reactions that the Google Home has given with a different question and understanding that Google Home will keep those questions in context. So if I ask for the weather in San Francisco and it gives me the weather and then I can respond with what about San Diego without saying the words weather, it still knows that was part of the previous conversation. And so it ties that together.
Is it now the speed is an issue? It's not as fast as Assistant or Alexa. What about that? How is it keeping up?
Well, this is kind of unproven as far as the performance goes. There was a demonstration on stage during the Galaxy Note 9 event where the presenter asked for a ride to the airport. And just saying, I need a ride to the airport, was the entire command that was given. And Bixby responded by saying, I booked you an Uber. It's going to be here at your location in a few minutes to take you to JFK. Which is very cool, but there was a period of time there where the app had to kind of go into the Uber app and make these button presses for you. Mm-hmm. And so that just takes time, going through the app kind of automatically and doing those things. So it's not clear how many different things Bixby is going to be able to kind of automatically do and whether those things are actually faster. But it's something that is probably going to be an issue moving forward. If you give a command and then you kind of have to wait 30 seconds for it to respond, that can be a little off-putting for people trying to use it.
Can it just say, hang on, I'm checking?
Yes, there's a bunch of different kind of usability things that could go in there.
Okay. You wanted to talk about Super Smash Brothers. It's a super popular game. It's been around a long time. It's been transferred from video game console to video game console. Why is it a big deal that it's being transferred to the Nintendo Switch?
Well, it's being transferred to the Nintendo Switch in a way that is kind of massive online multiplayer as well as local multiplayer, which is a big thing that the Switch does very well, is getting people into the same room to kind of play together on their own local network and not really requiring a hotspot or internet connections. People can just kind of meet up in a coffee shop and play together, which frequently happens. And so that's kind of a big deal as far as being able to get people in a room together to play. But this game in particular is kind of the next generation of this fighting style game with all of the Nintendo characters from so many different Nintendo properties and elsewhere. And in doing so, Nintendo has pulled every single character from every single version of Super Smash Brothers games that have ever existed and made them a part of this game. So, there was the original Super Smash Brothers, there was a list of characters, but not all of them made it to the next version of the game.
Right.
Nintendo was trying out other characters. To make sure that this is something that is, appeals to every single fan of the game from across, generations at this point, Nintendo is working very hard to just make every single character available.
It's an interesting way to roll that out. I mean, to appeal multi-generationally like that.
It's a big part of what has made the Nintendo Switch so successful is appealing to this kind of multi-generational group because, there was a big conversation a couple of years ago about how adults who played video games either played video games sitting in front of the television or on their phone, and there really wasn't any space in between.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nintendo Switch kind of acted against that, by having this console that you played on the television, but then also took out with you other places. And it turns out it's been very popular.
There are going to be new characters. So, first of all, when you talk about all the characters that ever were with Super Smash Brothers, how many characters are we talking there?
We have not gotten a complete list yet.
Okay.
Nintendo has been doing a very good job kind of slowly teasing how many things are being to get people very excited. And we just had a big presentation last week where, some 15 more characters were added. And we're going to have another event next week where I assume Nintendo will also, tease one or two other characters.
And there's going to be new characters.
There will be new characters from, the series that have come up since the last Smash Brothers. We will likely see characters from all kinds of new games, as well as revised versions of characters from the new version of Legend of Zelda that came out for the Switch.
Okay.
and what are called trophy characters that are assistants from other games, such as the really popular PC and platform game called Shovel Knight.
There are also new battlefields.
Yeah, so a big part of this is, you choose the fighters that you want, and then you choose the battlefield that you're playing on, and the battlefields always look kind of themed to a bunch of other popular Nintendo games. So, like, it can be, a Pokemon Stadium or something like that, that you can play in. And this is going to have, I think the number right now is 25 different arenas to play in, which is a pretty considerable number compared to some of the other versions of the game.
So are you looking forward to this?
I am. This is something that, I am terrible at this game, but I love playing it. So it's a fun thing to kind of constantly see. It's really just chaos. All of these characters kind of fighting
exactly.
On these not quite two-dimensional maps. It's really chaotic to play, but it's a lot of fun to watch. So it's a really enjoyable kind of frenetic experience that I think just draws people in.
And it's heavily invested in music for the game on Switch. They're offering 800 music tracks. Wow.
Yeah, so a big part of that is not only are the music tracks kind of a big deal, but you can assemble your own kind of play score based on the tracks that you really like from the game franchises that you really like. So, as you're playing, you can say, only these 60 songs are the songs that I want to hear because these are my favorites. And so those end up being the songs that you hear throughout your entire gameplay experience.
Yeah, but if you're playing with other people, is that what they hear too?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
I think that's going to be a little different depending on how that gets set up. It'll probably be what you hear through your console, but probably not what everyone hears.
OneCast. Tell us about OneCast and what it does and what they want to do.
OneCast is this really cool kind of sneaky thing that lets you stream Xbox games to Mac products. You know, in the past, Xbox games have only been capable of streaming to Windows-based systems. So if you have a Windows laptop and you're not at home, you can stream games from your Xbox to your Windows laptop and kind of play that. But it wasn't something that really worked on Macs very well until this third-party system called OneCast got created. And it works pretty well on Mac laptops. There's been a recent update this past week that allows it to also work on your iPhone and your iPad, effectively making it so that you can be sitting on your couch and you know, someone else is using the television, and you can pull out your Xbox controller and your iPhone and actually play your Xbox games on your using your phone as your screen.
Why didn't it create an app for Apple and other iOS devices? Why did it leave that out in the first place?
I think Microsoft understood that you know, there just wasn't a ton of gamers who own Macs. You know, it's been kind of a really common refrain for a long time is that Mac players are not really gamers. And I think especially now with the popularity of the iPhone, that's just not really true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that Microsoft kind of fell into that trap, and these guys, the people behind this app, kind of filled in the gap for them.
You have to be connected to the same internet network as the Xbox to use the app. Doesn't that defeat the purpose of mobile gaming?
No, like I said, a big part of this is, you know, people who have kind of the central TV in the living room and someone's using it to watch something, but you still want to play your games. It's actually a pretty common reason for game streaming to begin with, is so that you can, you know, kind of be in a different part of the house and still get to enjoy your games. And there are kind of clumsy ways to make it work outside of the house. It's just not nearly as reliable.
Okay. You wanted to talk about Palm Pepito. Palm is a mobile phone. Pepito is a diminutive reference in Spanish. What's the deal here?
Yeah, so Palm used to make phones that people bought, and then Palm stopped being a thing. And like BlackBerry and like Nokia, we're seeing this kind of resurgence where a company is buying the brand and using it to make an Android phone. And so this phone has been leaked. It may or may not come out later this year. It is a very small Palm phone. Palm phones were frequently kind of infamous for being smaller than what most people considered regular smartphones to be at the time, and now that is doubly so. And so this phone could be coming out later this year and be a Palm-branded phone that runs Android, which would be a very unusual thing that may or may not be totally terrible.
Do you think there's a market for smaller phones?
I hear from a lot of people that, you know, being able to hold your phone in one hand is something that is of value. I think the trade-off people make there is that smaller phones typically mean smaller batteries and unfortunately also tend to mean less quality when it comes to cameras and things like that.
Oh, okay.
And so people make the sacrifice and go with the bigger phone because it usually means the better camera and the bigger battery.
But don't you think that'll change over time?
I certainly hope it does because I am one of the people who prefer smaller phones, but
yeah,
I don't always get what I want.
But it says for the Palm Pepito, the battery is very light compared to other smartphones. So they're kind of dealing with that.
It certainly could be. It really all depends on how the operating system ends up running as to whether that battery really kind of means a certain set of experiences are guaranteed.
Hmm. And the display is just over 3 inches. Compare that to what we think of a typical smartphone today.
Yeah, it is more than half. It is less than half the size of the Galaxy Note 9 screen.
Hmm. What do you think of that?
I think it makes me happy to do anything but watch a video.
Right. Okay. Well, Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He's contributing editor for Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.